This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone, and this hour we put medical data, how it's gathered and how it's reported, under the microscope.
The result is that pseudoscience and non-science is being published bearing the imprimatur of science.
So for women, housework prevents breast cancer, but for men, shopping could make you impotent.
There was probably unconscious racist overtones in that continuing willingness to believe that Piltdown was a true discovery.
We looked at the oldest English language attraction and found, I think it was 1756, involving Ben Franklin, of all people.
Always been dubious of his paper about flatulence.
We're really not in a great position to challenge them as long as we don't really know what causes autism.
If they feel like they're kind of being played by their doctor or by the medical community, that's not something that's going to foster a relationship of trust.
How modern medicine paints by numbers, up next.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Bob Garfield is still away, but you'll get a little taste of him later in this hour, which, this holiday weekend, we've decided to devote to the festive theme of bad data, especially in medical reporting. We'll talk about an information industry riddled with accidental and intentional error, dating from Ben Franklin and the Piltdown Man to the current arguments over autism. We'll consider a research business model built on painting by numbers, often wrong numbers. And we'll start with epidemiologist Ben Goldacre, author of Bad Pharma and Bad Science. He is, needless to say, one of bad data's liveliest critics. In this excerpt from a 2011 TED Talk, he gives us a tour of the minefield of medical numbers. But be warned, he talks fast.
I'm a doctor, but I kind of slipped sideways into research, and now I'm an epidemiologist. And nobody really knows what epidemiology is. Epidemiology is the science of how we know in the real world if something is good for you or bad for you. And it's best understood, through example, as the science of those crazy, wacky newspaper headlines. These are from the Daily Mail. Every country in the world has a newspaper like this. It has this kind of bizarre, ongoing philosophical project of dividing all the inanimate objects in the world, really, into the ones that either cause or prevent cancer. So here are some of the things they've said cause cancer recently: divorce, Wi-Fi, toiletries, and coffee. Here are some of the things they say prevent cancer: crust, red pepper, licorice, and coffee. So already you can see there are contradictions here. Coffee both causes and prevents cancer. And as you start to read on, you can see that maybe there's some kind of political valence behind some of this. So for women, housework prevents breast cancer, but for men, shopping could make you impotent. So we know that we need to start unpicking the science behind this. And what I hope to show is that unpicking dodgy claims, unpicking the evidence behind dodgy claims, isn't a kind of nasty carping activity. Real science is all about critically appraising the evidence for somebody else's position. That's what happens in academic journals. That's what happens at academic conferences. The Q&A session after a postdoc presents data is often a bloodbath. And nobody minds that. We actively welcome it. It's like a kind of consenting intellectual S&M activity. So what I'm going to show you is all of the main themes, all of the main features of my discipline, evidence-based medicine. And I will talk you through all of these and demonstrate how they work, exclusively using examples of people getting stuff wrong. So we'll start with the absolute weakest form of evidence known to man, and that is authority. In science, we don't care how many letters you have after your name. In science, we want to know what your reasons are for believing something. How do you know that something is good for us or bad for us? But we're also unimpressed by authority because it's so easy to contrive. This is somebody called Dr. Gillian McKeith, PhD. She is our TV diet guru. She has massive kind of 5 series of primetime television giving out very lavish and exotic health advice. She, it turns out, has a non-accredited correspondence course, PhD, from somewhere in America. She also boasts that she's a certified professional member of the American Association of Nutritional Consultants, which sounds very glamorous and exciting. You get a certificate and everything. This one belongs to my dead cat, Hetty. She was a horrible cat. You just go to the website website, fill out the form, give them $60, and it arrives in the post. Now, that's not the only reason that we think this person is an idiot. She also goes on and says things like, you should eat lots of dark green leaves because they contain lots of chlorophyll, and that will really oxygenate your blood. And anybody who's done school biology remembers that chlorophyll in chloroplasts only makes oxygen in sunlight, and it's quite dark in your bowels after you've eaten spinach. Next. We need proper science, proper evidence. So, red wine could help prevent breast cancer. This is a headline from the Daily Telegraph in the UK. A glass of red wine a day could help prevent breast cancer. So you go and find this paper, and what you find is, it is a real piece of science. It's a description of the changes in the behavior of one enzyme when you drip a chemical extracted from some red grape skin onto some cancer cells in a dish on a bench in a laboratory somewhere. And that's a really useful thing to describe in a scientific paper. But on the question of your own personal risk of getting breast cancer if you drink red wine, it tells you absolutely bugger all, okay? So, ideally what you want to do is a trial, and everybody thinks they're very familiar with the idea of a trial. Trials are very old. The first trial was in the Bible, Daniel 1:12. It's very straightforward. You take a bunch of people, you split them in half, you treat one group one way, you treat the other group the other way, and then a little while later you follow them up and see what happened to each of them. So I'm going to tell you about one trial, which is probably the most well-reported trial in the UK news media over the past decade. And this is a trial of fish oil pills. And the claim was fish oil pills improve school performance and behavior in mainstream children. And they said, we've done a trial. All the previous trials were positive, and we know this one's going to be too. That should always ring alarm bells, right? Because if you already know the answer to your trial, you shouldn't be doing one. Either you've rigged it by design, or you've got enough data so there's no need to randomize people anymore. So this is what they were going to do in their trial. They were taking 3,000 children. They were going to give them all these huge fish oil pills, six of them a day. And then a year later, they were going to measure their school exam performance and compare their exam performance against what they predicted their exam performance would have been if they hadn't had the pills. Now, can anybody spot a flaw in this design? And no professors of clinical trial methodology are allowed to answer this question. So there's no control. Okay, there's no control group, but that sounds really techy, right? That sounds really, no, that's a technical term. The kids got the pills and then their performance improved. What else could it possibly be if it wasn't the pills? There's the placebo effect. The placebo effect is one of the most fascinating things in the whole of medicine. It's not just about taking a pill and your performance and your pain getting better. It's about our beliefs and expectations. It's about the cultural meaning of a treatment. And this has been demonstrated in a whole raft of fascinating studies comparing one kind of placebo against another. So we know, for example, that two sugar pills a day are a more effective treatment for getting rid of gastric ulcers than one sugar pill a day. Two sugar pills a day beats one sugar pill a day. And that's an outrageous and ridiculous finding, but it's true. So we know that our beliefs and expectations can be manipulated, which is why we do trials where we control against a placebo, where one half of the people get the real treatment and the other half get placebo. But that's not enough. What I've just shown you are examples of the very simple and straightforward ways that journalists and food supplement pill peddlers and naturopaths can distort evidence for their own purposes. What I find really fascinating is that the pharmaceutical industry use exactly the same kinds of tricks and devices, but slightly more sophisticated versions of them, in order to distort the evidence that they give to doctors and patients and which we use to make vitally important decisions. So, firstly, trials against placebo. Everybody thinks they know that a trial should be a comparison of your new drug against placebo, but actually, in a lot of situations, that's wrong, because often we already have a very good treatment that is currently available, so we don't want to know that your alternative new treatment is better than nothing. We want to know that it's better than the best currently available treatment that we have. And yet, repeatedly, you consistently see people doing trials still against placebo, and you can get licensed to bring your drug to market with only data showing that it's better than nothing, which is useless for a doctor like me trying to make a decision. But that's not the only way that you can rig your data. You can also rig your data by making the thing that you compare your new drug against really rubbish. You can give the competing drug in too low a dose so that people aren't properly treated. You can give the competing drug in too high a dose so that people get side effects. And this is exactly what happened with antipsychotic medication for schizophrenia. 20 years ago, a new generation of antipsychotic drugs were brought in, and the promise was that they would have fewer side effects. So people set about doing trials of these new drugs against the old drugs, but they gave the old drugs in ridiculously high doses, 20 milligrams a day of haloperidol. And it's a foregone conclusion if you give a drug at that higher dose that it will have more side effects and that your new drug will look better. 10 years ago, history repeated itself, interestingly, when risperidone, which was the first of the new generation antipsychotic drugs, came off copyright, so anybody could make copies. Everybody wanted to show that their drug was better than risperidone, so you see a bunch of trials comparing new antipsychotic drugs against risperidone at 8 milligrams a day. Again, not an insane dose, not an illegal dose, but very much at the high end of normal, and so you're bound to make your new drug look better. And so it's no surprise that overall, industry-funded trials are 4 times more likely to give a positive result than independently sponsored trials. The negative data goes missing in action. It's withheld from doctors and patients. And this is the most important aspect of the whole story. It's at the top of the pyramid of evidence. We need to have all of the data on a particular treatment to know whether or not it really is effective. This is a drug called Reboxetine, and this is a drug which I myself have prescribed to patients. And I'm a very nerdy doctor. I hope I go out of my way to try and read and understand all the literature. I read the trials on this. They were all positive. They were all well conducted. I found no flaw. Unfortunately, it turned out that many of these trials were withheld. In fact, 76% of all of the trials that were done on this drug were withheld from doctors and patients. Now, if you think about it, if I toss a coin 100 times and I'm allowed to withhold from you the answers half the times, then I can convince you that I have a coin with 2 heads, okay? If we remove half of the data, we can never know what the true effect size of these medicines is. And this is not an isolated story. Around half of all of the trial data on antidepressants has been withheld, but it goes way beyond that. The Nordic Cochrane Group were trying to get hold of the data on that to bring it all together. The Cochrane Groups are an international non-profit collaboration that produce systematic reviews of all of the data that has ever been shown, and they need to have access to all of the trial data. But the companies withheld that data from them, and so did the European Medicines Agency for 3 years. This is a problem that is currently lacking a solution. And to show how big it goes, this is a drug called Tamiflu, which governments around the world have spent billions and billions of dollars on. And they spend that money on the promise that this is a drug which will reduce the rate of complications with flu. We already have the data showing that it reduces the duration of your flu by a few hours, but I don't really care about that. Governments don't care about that. We prescribe these drugs, we stockpile them for emergencies on the understanding they will reduce the number of complications, which means pneumonia and which means death. The infectious diseases Cochrane Group, which are based in Italy, have been trying to get the full data in a usable form out of the drug company so that they can make a full decision about whether this drug is effective or not, and they've not been able to get that information. This is undoubtedly the single biggest ethical problem facing medicine today. All of these things are happening in plain sight, and they're all protected by a kind of force field of tediousness. And I think with all of the problems in science, one of the best things that we can do is to lift up the lid, finger around at the mechanics, and peer in. Thank you very much.
Coming up, pay-to-play medical journals, and an enterprising biologist gains the peer review process by supplying fake addresses of supposed peers.
Well, what Young and Moon did was, instead of putting Dr. Jones at, you know, harvard.edu, it was drjones1@gmail.com. And guess who controlled those email addresses but Young and Moon?
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from the Lemelson Foundation, supporting inventors and invention to improve lives in the U.S. and developing countries. On the web at Lemelson.org, the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness. On the web at MelvilleTrust.org and Wix.com, enabling over 30 million local businesses to create customized websites with the Wix website builder at Wix.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone with a deeper look into medical journals that influence what your doctor prescribes, that affect your own well-being. It used to be that libraries, mostly college libraries, did most of the paying for those pricey academic journals. But early in the third millennium, two things changed. First, those libraries started to balk at the astronomical subscription prices. And second, the open access movement took off, which sought to make information free to everyone online. Some journals responded by making their contents free to the online public. Instead, the scholars whose work those journals published would pay. Now, at first, Jeffrey Beal, an academic librarian at the University of Colorado, was enthusiastic until he started to get offers from what looked suspiciously like bogus journals to publish him for a price. As he told Bob, just before Bob went on his vision quest, Beal started assembling a list of sham journals with seemingly shady aspirations.
What some publishers are doing is accepting as many papers as they can just to earn the author fees.
Now, are these publishers who are tricking academics into thinking that they're getting into a reputable journal? Or is it kind of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge kind of deal where all parties know exactly what's being bought and paid for?
Well, the answer is both. The publishers are very good at making themselves look legitimate. One of the tricks they use is to send personalized spam email to individual authors requesting that they submit a manuscript to a particular journal. They praise an earlier work by the same author, and this strategy works very well on junior faculty, graduate students, and postdocs who are unfamiliar with the scholarly publishing process. Oftentimes, the publishers don't mention the author fee in the spam email that they send to the authors.
For those who do know what's going on, for those who submit a paper understanding full well that there's no peer review, what does that mean to us at the end of the process in the ecosystem of science?
I think your question is asking how does this affect science? And the fact is, new research builds on existing research that's recorded in the academic record. The result is that pseudoscience and non-science is being published bearing the imprimatur of science. And this has a tremendous negative effect on science itself and on scientists.
I don't mind if my pastor has gotten a theological degree from a diploma mill and no actual training, but I'm really nervous, you know, if my airplane pilot has gotten his credentials the same way. Do I have to worry that in some areas of science, medicine, and technology that the plane's going to crash because the pilot's a fraud?
Yes, you do. Lawyers in legal cases, they often refer to scholarly articles to establish the truth in a case. Public policymakers rely on research. And the medical profession also relies on research as it gets translated into clinical practice. And the more bad research we have published in the system, the more that research negatively affects the entire ecosystem, as you say.
Do you ever get kind of wistful about the bad old days of monopolist academic publishers and limited access?
Well, I do. There were a lot of good things about the old model, and that's not to say there's not good things about the new model, but the old model played a very important validation function. If your article was published in one of the traditional publishers' journals, everybody knew that it had to go through a very rigorous peer review. Today, we don't know if a particular article is a good one or not.
What do we do?
The problem is, in most cases, the predatory publishers aren't doing anything wrong. They enjoy the same benefit of freedom of speech that we all enjoy. I've made a list of them and have been advising scholars not to submit their work to them, not to serve on their editorial boards.
And some of them don't like your list. One Indian publisher threatened to sue you for $1 billion and to file a criminal complaint that would put you in jail for 3 years.
I've gotten a couple of threatening letters from publishers. Fortunately, none has resulted in a lawsuit.
What has the University of Colorado done for you? Have they encouraged you to keep on keeping on, or perhaps to keep a slightly lower profile?
I get mixed messages from my university. Legal staff will represent me in case a lawsuit really does get filed. Universities these days are too much controlled by the public relations departments, I think, and they want news to be happy. They're not happy at my university, I think, with a list of predatory publishers. They're more happy to have a story about students distributing turkeys on Thanksgiving. So there has been some pressure on me. Most of it is indirect pressure, but it's pressure nonetheless. It's like the farther you get away from my university, the more my list is respected. The closer you get, the less it's respected.
Well, then I would certainly discourage you from going on any national radio programs to talk about it.
A lot of people have been helped by avoiding these predatory publishers. It's very easy to fall for their scams. So every day I get emails thanking me for my work.
All right, Jeffrey, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Bob.
Jeffrey Beal is a scholarly initiatives librarian at the University of Colorado at Denver and the author of Beal's List.
The discussion of bogus journals you just heard put us in mind of the blog Retraction Watch, launched in 2010. Its name is self-explanatory. It tracks retractions, specifically from science journals and especially life science journals. That's in part because its founders, Adam Marcus and Ivan Oransky, are both medical reporters in their day jobs. Oransky is also a doctor. We spoke with him soon after Retraction Watch was launched, but there have been hundreds of retractions since, and now they have a new retraction record holder. Ivan, welcome to On the Media.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me, Brooke.
So you've got a new retraction record holder. Congratulations.
We do. Yoshitaka Fuji has 183 retractions. 183 is a lot, especially when you consider that over the course of a year, there are somewhere between 400 and 500 retractions. So he's a big chunk of those.
He didn't retract them all in one year.
It's probably over the course of a little more than a year, but not in sort of a calendar year. These things tend to happen sort of all at once. In fact, that's really what happened with the last retraction record holder, Joaquin Bolt. The final tally looks like it was 89 papers.
Mm-hmm. Now, Bolt and Fuji are both anesthesiologists. What's the deal there?
Well, you could say that someone's asleep at the switch, or you could actually say the opposite, which is that there's someone named Steve Schaefer, a journal editor at one of the major anesthesiology journals, and he's really taken, you know, a really strong position on correcting the scientific literature. And so whenever he sees something that might be amiss, he really pushes institutions, universities, to do proper investigations.
So the fact that all of these retractions are showing up in anesthesiology isn't because anesthesiologists lie more. It's just that Schaefer is so committed to transparency in correcting the record.
A lot of it is that. And to be fair, Adam Marcus, my co-founder, is actually the managing editor of a newspaper called Anesthesiology News. So obviously he's attuned to this, and Steve's a good source of his. But I would also say that having more retractions in a particular area may in fact be a signal of quality and of transparency. We looked at the oldest English language retraction once and found, I think it was 1756, involving Ben Franklin, of all people.
I've always been dubious of his paper about flatulence.
He has had quite a lot of colorful papers, we'll put it that way.
The last record holder, Bolt, had fewer than half of the current record holder, Fuji. Does that suggest that there is a dramatic increase in retractions?
The number has gone up about tenfold, and some of it is just awareness. It isn't just a very small community of people who had to go to the basement of the library, pull the journal out of the stacks. Well, everything's online. It means that there are more eyeballs looking at problematic figures, for example. There's also plagiarism detection software that picks up whether it's duplicating your own work, not considered kosher, but also good old-fashioned plagiarism where you're actually taking someone else's work.
Let me ask you about the peer review process, which has always been something we lay people have wanted to believe in, scientists weighing in on each other's work and lending their expertise. You've cited several cases in which the author of a paper has given himself or herself star feedback.
This is a fascinating story. It's probably one of my favorites. Young In Moon is a Korean plant scientist. He had a whole bunch of papers he wanted to publish. And a lot of publishers will ask, especially in a very narrow area where there aren't that many other experts, they will ask, who else could review this paper? And so Young In Moon would say, oh, Dr. Jones, she's an expert in this subject. And the editor would do a quick check and say, oh, Dr. Jones, of course, yes, she's at the University of blah, blah, blah. She's clearly published in this area. Well, what Young In Moon did was instead of putting Dr. Jones at, you know, harvard.edu, it was drjones1@gmail.com. And guess who controlled those email addresses but Young In Moon? So long story short, all the reviews came back, shockingly, Brooke, as positive. Yes, you should publish this paper. And he had that very specific, oh, you should fix this and this paragraph is off or this table should be in blue or whatever. But what nailed him was that they all came back within 24 hours. And if you talk to journal editors, they don't even get a, yes, I'd be happy to peer review that paper in 24 hours, let alone a detailed review. But I think it speaks to a larger issue in peer review. I mean, peer review in some ways has been, I think, oversold. We've seen so many things that aren't right. I happen to think journalists can often do as good a job at peer review after the fact.
Funniest retraction?
Some of the funny things we see are euphemism for plagiarism. And we see things like unattributed overlap. Well, that's plagiarism. Or one paper actually described plagiarism very clearly and then said the authors apologize for this approach to writing this paper. So Adam said, plagiarism is an approach to writing a paper the same way bank robbery is an approach to banking. We had things like a significant originality issue. Yes, I mean, and if you bring this paper to therapy, I think maybe it will deal with those originality issues and be less angry at its father and maybe come out and talk about it.
Ivan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke. This has been fun.
Ivan Oransky is a medical journalist, a doctor, and founder, along with Adam Marcus, of the blog Retraction Watch. And now for your delectation, one of our favorite interviews about men messing with biological information. It's an old case involving a piece of a very old man, garnished with ape. More than a century ago, a skull that looked human and a jaw that looked apish were presented at a special meeting of the Geological Society in London. The so-called Piltdown Man became widely accepted as a crucial link in the human evolutionary chain. Crucial, that is, until 1953, when the bones were exposed as a total hoax. Last December, I spoke to NOVA senior science editor Evan Haddingham about this tantalizing example of scientific skullduggery.
Charles Dawson was a well-to-do solicitor who lived in the town of Lewes in Sussex, one of the richest areas in the whole of Britain for geological and archaeological finds. And so in this town was a thriving group of amateur collectors. They were highly competitive. Dawson had been roaming the downs for decades, and every now and then he'd send some curious discovery to Arthur Smith Woodward, who was the curator at the British Museum of Natural History in London.
And Smith Woodward lent a lot of credibility to the Piltdown discovery, even though scientists suspected that the skull and the mandible actually came from different skeletons.
There was some initial skepticism about the find, but every time a serious point of debate was raised, lo and behold, a piece of fossil would crop up almost miraculously, which answered some of the objections that called the find into question.
But interestingly, it was foreigners who were more skeptical than the Brits. And this brings us to the political context.
Well, 1912, it's before the outbreak of the Great War, of course, which shook up the values of all the imperial powers. So it's still the height of the British Empire. Playing into a sense of national pride was the notion that perhaps England had been the entire center for the origin of humanity. Surely it was about time that Britain had its own discovery on par with those that had been found in Germany with the Neanderthals and so on. There was probably unconscious racist overtones in that continuing willingness to believe that Piltdown was a true discovery. In the 1920s, the first discoveries were made of ancestral humans in southern Africa. And they were very easy to reject because even though Darwin thought that Africa was the probable place of origin for humanity, it was far more comfortable to think of this man-ape in England being a formative character in our past as opposed to a place like Africa.
Since Piltdown was exposed as a hoax in 1953, people have floated theories about who the hoaxer was. Some have implicated Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
The evidence that Conan Doyle had anything to do with this consists mostly in parallels in Conan Doyle's famous tale, The Lost World, about a lost colony of ancient humans that coexisted with the dinosaurs on a plateau in South America in the present day. Conan Doyle did know Dawson. They did lunch together. And Conan Doyle may have chatted to Dawson about his developing idea for this exciting novel. And it's possible that that actually planted the idea of the hoax in Dawson's mind, not the other way around.
Why did Smith Woodward never begin to doubt Piltdown? Anytime anyone ever found anything, Dawson was always there.
He really charmed Smith Woodward. Smith Woodward also invested a huge amount of his reputation and career in Piltdown. For over 20 years, he dug every summer, rather sadly, never finding anything again. So during Smith Woodward's lifetime, it was very unlikely that anybody would critically examine the remains. But in 1948, he died.
So that brings us to the late 40s and early 50s. A couple of scientists tried to assess the Piltdown remains. What sort of high-tech CSI techniques were available to them at the time?
They ran the relatively newly discovered radiocarbon test, and the shocking truth finally came out. It was a modern jaw of an orangutan, and the skull fragments belonged to a modern human, possibly from a medieval cemetery. And once suspicions about the date were raised, they did something really basic, which was to really examine the teeth of the jaw under a magnifying glass. And lo and behold, it was obvious that they'd been filed flat. And that was why they didn't resemble an ape's tooth. The most obvious piece of the fraud was a canine tooth that was found in 1913, planted by Dawson a year after the first remains. Because you can't stain a tooth the way you can bone, the hoaxer actually used paint on the root of the tooth. What looks obvious today wasn't at all obvious to the specialists back then because of their expectations.
So in terms of scientific hoaxes, is there anything that compares to Piltdown?
Not really. Piltdown still stands as the preeminent story of scientific skullduggery.
Pun not intended.
Sorry. Anyway, it really did have an extraordinary influence on the way we saw human evolution. It fooled the scientific community for four decades, and there's been nothing like that ever since.
What drew you so deeply into the Piltdown story?
It's the ultimate Agatha Christie story. Charles Dawson had a well-documented and burning ambition to make his mark on the scientific world. People have looked at the other things that Dawson collected. And at the present time, I believe the count of fraudulent objects is 38. Spanning a couple of decades, Dawson had forged not just bones and stones, but Roman statuettes. And there was even a sea monster that he claimed to have seen crossing the English Channel. All of these things fall into the picture of a very smart but compulsively dishonest and manipulative collector. We really don't know the fine details of how Dawson did this. You can get completely lost in the search for hints in letters and so on. For anybody who loves masterpiece mystery, you can find all of that in the Piltdown story.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brooke.
Evan Haddingham is Senior Science Editor for WGBH's Nova. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This month, a study linked autism to some forms of in vitro fertilization. Last month, a study linked it to air pollution. But the so-called cause that's generated the most ink over the years is vaccines. Scientists have firmly established that childhood vaccines do not cause autism. Wait, hear that? That's the sound of hundreds of keyboards clacking as angry parents rush to correct me. Many are probably citing Andrew Wakefield, the British doctor who was the lead author on a 1998 study in the Lancet Medical Journal that implicated the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine with the rise of autism diagnoses. But Wakefield's work was shown to be so unreliable that Lancet editor Richard Horton publicly retracted the paper in early 2010.
This was a system failure. We failed. I think the media failed. I think government failed. I think the scientific community failed. And we all have to very critically examine what part we played in this.
A few months later, Wakefield was stripped of his medical license. Finally, a 2011 investigation claimed that his original work had not only been flawed, but fraudulent. So, with that important corrective out there, why is it that in 2011 we learned measles infections had hit a 15-year high in the United States? Seth Mnookin, author of The Panic Virus, told us last year that this strange rise in preventable diseases has its roots in two groups of vaccine-averse parents. The first is a small core of diehard conspiracy theorists.
The people who were most committed to the idea that there's a link between vaccines and autism, for the most part, already believed that the medical community and international governments around the world were conspiring to hide evidence. And so any further piece of evidence disproving that link becomes kind of paradoxically further proof of this conspiracy. The second and larger group has almost by osmosis picked up on what has now been almost a decade and a half of these concerns about vaccines. And so they may express those as a fear that children are getting too many vaccines or a desire to have their child develop, quote, natural immunity, which some people very, very mistakenly see as being safer. Their concerns are typically much more inchoate and vague.
I mean, is the problem that most people just don't think measles are that scary?
It's more that most people just don't think that vaccine-preventable diseases are an actual threat in 2012. The risk is overstating the likelihood that their child is going to get infected, because I think parents are pretty savvy about that. And if they feel like they're kind of being played by their doctor or by the medical community, that's not something that's going to foster a relationship of trust.
Has there been a systemic problem in the way it's been covered?
Absolutely. I actually think the moment of original sin in here is not the Wakefield paper, but the coverage of the Wakefield paper, because that was a study of 12 children. It's what's called a case series. And it's absolutely insane for any journalist to take the results of a 12-person case series and draw these population-wide conclusions from this. The paper, as soon as it came out in The Lancet, was called by many people the worst paper that The Lancet had ever published. So it wasn't as if there was some period in which this seemed like it might have been really good work. It seemed from the very beginning that it was deficient, that there were conclusions being drawn that far outstripped what the data showed. And I think you see that a lot in science coverage and medicine. You have someone making an outrageous claim, and even if everyone in that field line up on the other side, it's presented as scientists' debate. I've talked to reporters who covered the Wakefield paper in 1998, and they've said, well, we eventually got it right. That really seems like a cop-out to me. It's impossible to unscare someone.
I wonder if this problem isn't baked into journalism, not just the desire to cover a conflict where the two sides are evenly matched, but also in this case, particularly, the narrative is skewed towards the wrong side. I mean, on one side, you have parents bravely battling for their children's lives. And then on the other, the big bad pharmaceutical companies. I mean, anyone who's ever gone to a movie knows who they're supposed to vote for.
It's why Aaron Brockovich is a successful movie and the opposite of it would not be. There is a certain part of it baked into journalism, but it's much more prevalent in politics, science, and medicine. You don't see it in business. If someone came along and said, hey, everyone, my company is actually as valuable as Apple, no business reporter would write a piece saying John Doe, who just started this company, claims that his company is as valuable as Apple. Apple Computers says actually it's, it has more cash than any other company in the world, because it would be ridiculous. But you do get that in science and medicine and in politics when, you know, someone makes an outrageous claim and journalists act as if coming down and saying that's false or not even reporting it because it's demonstrably false would somehow mean that they were taking a side. I think that's a ridiculous notion. I think that committing yourself to reporting what is accurate does not mean that you're taking a side.
Seth, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Seth Mnookin is the author of The Panic Virus, The True Story Behind the Autism Vaccine Controversy. Not long ago, The Onion produced a series of segments called Autistic Reporter, in which an actor playing someone somewhere on the autistic spectrum is sent out for on-the-spot reports. You can see where this is going. Here's the Autistic Reporter on missing hikers.
The hikers were last seen 174 hours ago. Since then, three very big storms have hit here. There's a 1.24% chance that all of the hikers are alive. There's a 3.87% chance that one or more of the hikers are alive.
In Florida, the Autism Channel puts real people from the autism spectrum in front of the camera. The channel is available on Roku, a device that streams the internet onto your TV, and is aimed at the growing number of families who have a child diagnosed on the spectrum, as well as people diagnosed with autism themselves. In late 2012, we send On the Media producer Chris Neary to Florida, where the channel is based, to check it out.
So a few months ago, I had lunch with Daniel Heinlein. The first thing I found out, when he was a kid, he really liked television.
I would just sit there and watch the $25,000 pyramid all day.
$10,000, that'll take you up to 24.
And I would come up with my own game shows, and I would memorize the game show hosts.
For $10,000, here is your first subject. Go!
A rabbit's foot, a four-leaf
guitar. I would sit in class in second grade and draw sets for game shows. I would write music for game shows. It was all I cared about.
Parts of your body.
A wishbone.
Things you break, things you...
Daniel has Asperger's syndrome, a high-functioning kind of autism, which often features these sorts of obsessions. Growing up, he memorized maps of southern Wisconsin, where he's from. He also absorbed the entire history of the Hartford Whalers, a hockey team that doesn't exist anymore.
When I was about 2 years old, I would watch the commercials between shows, and when the commercials were over, I would cry. My parents would tape all the commercials and just put them on a loop so I could watch the same commercials for Pillsbury microwave brownies over and over.
Daniel struggled academically and socially in high school. He didn't pick up on basic social cues, things like maintaining eye contact and standing the right distance away from someone when you're talking to them. Things have improved the last few years, but at 26, he lives with his parents. Some companies seek out people like Daniel because they're capable of such sustained focus. One Danish company matches people on the spectrum to jobs in the tech industry. Autism advocate Temple Grandin suggests careers in engineering and computer programming. What you won't see on that list of compatible jobs is TV host for a streaming cable channel. And yet...
When I was very young, I was on track to do great things in school. But as I got older, I started having problems. But after years of struggles, I was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome. I didn't believe it, and begrudgingly went with it. But now I feel I'm part of the autistic community, one which in the United States alone numbers over 16 million people.
I'm Daniel Heinlein, and I am autistic.
In I Am Autistic, Daniel interviews people in the autistic world, both on and off the spectrum. Daniel's autism is mild. It's just one part of the spectrum. On the other end of the spectrum, some people don't talk. Others attack themselves and need constant supervision. You might think of people on the spectrum as having a static condition, but they can improve their social skills. Daniel's upbringing helped. His grandparents owned a radio station. His father was a radio announcer. And of course, being on television has helped. For instance, it's helped him cultivate a sense of empathy, a trait that talk show hosts often have to fake.
I wasn't naturally an empathetic person until I started doing the work with the channel and meeting all these people and finding out all the things that they're struggling with and finding out that there are people who are like me, there are people who are worse off than I am.
We probably wouldn't be doing this channel if it weren't for Daniel.
Jerry Trowbridge is the co-founder of the Autism Channel.
Finding somebody with a social disorder who can connect with the camera is really a difficult thing to find.
Most people enter the autistic world when their child is diagnosed. But Jerry and his business partner, Ray Smithers, have no personal connection. They just had an idea for a pilot of Daniel's show that they nearly sold to the Oprah Winfrey Network. Jerry is 60, Ray is 70. They're bankrolling the station for now. Costs are in the high five figures so far, and there's no ad revenue yet. So, with one assistant, they book the guests, operate the cameras, do post-production, upload the shows, and promote the station online. If Jerry and Ray have a goal, it's to use the channel to take some of the stigma away from being on the spectrum.
A lot of people will tell you it's a disaster, it's an epidemic, it's terrible, and there are certainly aspects of that. But we are also developing a society that many of the members think differently, and that's not necessarily bad. One of the people who does in-home videos with us says, I'm not out to change my child. I'm out to change the environment my child lives in.
The Autism Channel's one small studio is set back from a two-lane road in a quiet part of West Palm Beach. On one side of the studio, there's a classic talk show set with chairs and couches and a coffee table. On the other side, a two-story green screen that allows them to create different backdrops for different shows. Right now, Daniel is interviewing Michael Garvin, who's on the spectrum himself, about his new show, Garvin on Garvin.
Hi, I'm Dan Heinlein, and welcome to I Am Autistic. Usually when I have a guest on here, I say, I'm here talking...
Garvin on Garvin is built around Garvin's quirks, which are many.
I may be autistic, but I think the rest of my family makes me look normal. So does that teleprompter. And so does my director, because he told me not to slouch. So I can't be a sloucher, because the teleprompter will not teleprompt.
Garvin has had and lost many jobs. He rubbed coworkers the wrong way. But in front of the camera, he's comfortable.
You know, I'm not going to hide it. I mean, I would wear clothes like green with purple shorts or something, and black socks with hard shoes. And everybody said, yeah, that guy's a weirdo. I said, I'm a weirdo. I might as well admit I'm a weirdo.
Jerry and Ray plan to make the Autism Channel available on more streaming devices to reach more viewers. But as the station grows, it'll run headlong into the most contentious issue in the autistic world: the alleged connection between vaccines and the soaring number of autism diagnoses. Now, this shouldn't be contentious. The Lancet Medical Journal article that propelled the issue was publicly discredited and withdrawn. After a 2011 review of more than 1,000 articles on the topic, the Institute of Medicine found no proof of a connection between vaccines and autism. And yet, a vocal minority of the autism community have stopped vaccinating their children. Jerry says the Autism Channel won't take sides. I asked him why not.
It's, to my mind, a dangerous view. You can endanger your child, other children. Do you have a responsibility as a journalist to challenge them?
We do, but we're really not in a great position to challenge them as long as we don't really know what causes autism.
But you know it's not that.
Do we? No.
Bad science doesn't prove anything. We have a lot of other people out there that are maybe not in the scientific mainstream, but are licensed doctors that believe that vaccines are somehow involved in the process.
Ray says the channel is committed to presenting all views without immediately rebutting any of them. Daniel, their star host, has not dealt directly with the vaccine issue on his show yet, but he has had guests advocate for some of the many unproven treatments for autism spectrum disorders, and he feels conflicted about confronting them.
I beat myself up over it. I feel like I can't really go hard on the people that I disagree with as hard as I'd like to. And I have to empathize with what the parents are going through, and sometimes I fear they're going to see me as like a traitor to my people, if they're my people in the first place, that I'm not advocating withholding vaccinations from your kids. In fact, I think that everyone should be vaccinated for the good of public health.
Dr. Judy Aronson-Ramos hosts The Dr. Judy Show, a talk show where she interviews autism experts. She's a behavioral pediatrician in nearby Coconut Beach, Florida, who has a daughter on the autism spectrum. Vaccines haven't come up on her show yet either. But if and when they do, she doesn't plan on being agnostic.
There are children who were healthy, got vaccinated, had a bad reaction, and are injured in some way. However, study after study after study after study that's good are showing no connection between vaccines and autism in general. So I'm not going to be an Anything Goes channel.
The channel only started streaming in late September. The way it handles the vaccine connection and other unproven treatments will go a long way to determining how it will be received by parents and experts who are drawn to the channel. But there are other viewers.
Okay, my eldest son is Broderick, and he's 11 years old. He's tall and average build. He's not incredibly athletic, but he's really good at playing chess, and he loves science. He lacks social skills tremendously.
Marlo Kruger-Kaufman lives in Ontario with her husband and three kids. Her two oldest, both boys, are on the spectrum.
My middle son, Riley, is more classic autism. He would lay somewhere on the spectrum between classic severe autism and a moderate autism. He has good days and he has bad days. He has days where he speaks and asks questions. And then there are days where he won't speak at all, and all he'll do is stim. And when he stims, he screams.
Stimming is a repetitive behavior. Marlo says that for Riley, that means he flicks his fingers around his eyes and screams. Sounds bad, but she says it means he's passing the day in complete joy. He loves the Autism Channel. It comforts him when he's not experiencing complete joy.
Hi, I'm Sam Rubin. When life gives you lemons, make lemonade. Here's my lemon.
The show the kids like best is the Rocket Family Chronicles, the fictionalized adventures of a real family led by their 19-year-old autistic son, Sam. He often addresses the camera directly.
Here's a scene from one of my first films. That's my dad. He's having a rough day. The character I play in the show is Rocket. He's somewhat like me. And now for Dust Bunny.
I asked Broderick, the 11-year-old, what he thinks of the show. What it's like seeing someone else with Asperger's on TV.
It's just pretty amazing. I've never thought that people with Asperger's could get jobs like that.
Would you want to be on television?
Yes.
Doing what?
I don't know. Story of my life.
After several years of living with Asperger's, I think you learn not to be self-conscious anymore.
That's Daniel Heinlein again.
Because if you're going to worry about what people think about you, you're never going to make it out of bed in the morning.
20 years ago, Daniel Heinlein watched Dick Clark hosting the $25,000 pyramid and fell in love with television. Today, Brody Kaufman can watch Daniel Heinlein. This may end up being the best thing the Autism Channel contributes to the autism world. A new place and a new way for people on the spectrum to see themselves. For On the Media, I'm Chris Neary.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary. We had more help from Olivia Wheats and Molly Buckley. On the Media's technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn. Katja Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news and our boss. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Bob Garfield really and truly will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.